Change is gonna come.
See that you actually are a leader.
I was with Nike for a very long time and built my career in retail.
You know, I think this podcast just got its first exclusive.
Being an entrepreneur is hard. The highs are really high and then the lows are really low.
That I'm actually really interested in hearing more about.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like transitioning verticals?
Being open to opportunity.
I feel like, okay, like if not now, then when?
Hi everyone, thanks so much for joining us on today's live Motivated podcast. We're back in person and we typically feature thought leaders and industry experts where we discuss what they're working on, some of the strategies they've deployed, and how they've shifted their mindset, not only during this time, but overall, how they're keeping themselves and the people around them motivated. My name is Dahlia Strom, and I teach marketing at the Fashion Institute of Technology, and I also run a company called Rethink Connect, where we focus on storytelling through experiential moments. And I am lucky enough to be back in person with my co-host, Pablo Henderson. I am so excited to see you. I can't even tell you. It's like exuding out of me. Pablo, welcome.
Not more excited than I am.
Really?
Person with my partner in crime, Dahlia Strom. I'm Pablo Henderson, VP of Marketing at Equinox Hotels, and this is the Motivated Podcast.
So excited to be here, and we have an amazing guest today. David, welcome. You and I have been speaking so much on Clubhouse, but I would love if you did a proper introduction for us.
A proper introduction for you or for me?
That's why I love you, David.
I could not possibly do you guys justice. So I'm David Spizak, and I am a lifetime entrepreneur, and I've focused most of my career has been in the transportation, mobility, automotive space, but I'm also a partner and investor in about five different software companies, a winery, a rather large four-star and five-star restaurant group, blockchain technology, and a number of other companies. So at heart, I'm a entrepreneur. I like to think of myself as a bit of a hybrid between being a creative thinker and a relatively logic-driven human being, which is probably going to lead to my demise ultimately.
No, I think it's actually amazing. I saw you in action in a work session on Tuesday, super impromptu, and you actually told a story that really resonated with me. I kind of shared it with Pablo, but I don't think I did it justice, where you sent a salesperson in your place to sell an experience, a product or a service to Brian Benstock, and he didn't do a great job. And I'd love to hear that story from your perspective.
So the first software company I created, you know, I had the genius idea to pivot and reinvent myself from being an executive in a Fortune 500 company, AutoNation, to being an entrepreneur and starting just shy of the age of 50. I thought, okay, what a fantastic time to start a software company at the leading edge of a significant recession. So
perfect timing, right?
Why not, right? I typically am the kind of person that if everybody's running to the left, I'm running to the right. Because the left, if you're all running in the same direction, the best you could hope for is average or perhaps slightly above average as an outcome. And I'd rather take the risk. So I did that. I started a company. It went quite well. And we ended up I was able to grow it to a pretty significant size relatively quickly. And I did it in a very non-traditional fashion. I didn't have a sales team. I spent less than $25,000 in marketing and advertising to acquire over 1,000 large clients. And
that's amazing,
and
by
that's
the way.
That's for another day, but that's kind of one of my secret sauce that others have never been able to replicate, and I've been able to do it over and over. So one of the customers that signed up was a gentleman named Brian Benstock, and he is considered the thought leader of all thought leaders for dealers in the United States. He's got the number one Honda and Acura dealership in the world. And so he signed up for my product, and when he saw the presentation, he was just like over the top excited because I created the first business intelligence platform for dealerships. And so when he saw the presentation, he was just over the moon. He went back, as people often do, and he shared with his team how excited he was about this product and how transformative it was going to be for the organization. Brian's somebody that, you know, my saying has always been, it's easier to climb Mount Everest than it is to live up there. And he's somebody who understands that very, very well. So as much as they've had this incredible level of success, he wants to keep looking up and driving. So he buys the product, he gets his team just all amped up. Well, I sold that particular company to a multi-billion dollar company, and one of their team members, I was completely dedicated to client service support. To me, that's the hallmark of a company, and it was what set us apart. Our company had less than 3% employee churn. The software industry in automotive is typically 15%. So we had an incredibly low client churn. Why? Because we absolutely nailed it when it came to implementation, training, client services, and support. Didn't happen. So the company that purchased sent a consultant out to do the training and implementation, but instead of doing it the way that myself or my team would have done it, they took a very corporate check the box in Brian's mind. So did they do the work? They did. If they're supposed to sit down with Pablo, did they do it? Check, I did that. Did I tell Dahlia about this feature? Check, I did that. But they just did a very poor job, unfortunately. Well, Brian...
It sounds like they didn't have heart. Like, it sounds like that's the piece that's missing.
Exactly. You have to have that ownership and that connection and that passion for the product. It almost has to be a mission.
Yeah.
Like, if I don't do this right, it's going to negatively impact this person, those employees. And that really is true. It's interesting that, and we'll get back to the story, but it's interesting that oftentimes people don't think in terms of in that context, that it's not just a matter of going out and implementing training. You know, by virtue of doing a phenomenal job, not only are you doing a great service for your own company, but what you're doing for that other company is putting them in the position to significantly increase their business, their client base, their profitability, which in turn puts them in position to hire more people, right? And that creates opportunities for additional people to get hired for high paying jobs. And so you gotta connect those dots.
That's so key. You just said something so important. The right people. And it's a reminder, like Pablo, I'm sure even on your end, it's finding the right people to be a part of your team, the right people to talk to people. Like, I think people talk about hiring so often, and if we miss the mark with the right people, everything falls flat.
I mean, at the end of the day, no one's going to share the same level of passion than you are when you're the founder or you're the leader. You have to find whatever that's going to be for that team and understand that it's not going to be the equivalent. It's going to be whatever their interpretation is of that same level of passion. And that is the key. That is the secret sauce in leadership, is tapping into that. Because if it was that easy to tap into, everybody would be doing it.
Yeah.
And it sounds like in this story, that process wasn't in place, and you... had to remedy it?
Or? Well, so what happened is Brian has got high expectations. And frankly, don't we all? I mean, I don't care. You know, if you jump into an Uber and it's going to be $30, you expect the car to be clean. You expect the driver to be courteous. You expect him to or her to go on the right route and to be efficient.
I think it's also the level, right? It's the level of expectation. When you're spending X amount 100%. Of money, your expectations increase exponentially too.
Yeah, if you're chartering a jet for $60,000 to go across country, it's a little different expectation than if you're jumping on Southwest or even if you're jumping into first class on American Airlines, whatever it might be. So I subscribe to that. But Brian's a person that really, there are people in this world, and I find that all high achievers have this hallmark. They have high levels of expectation for themselves. And if you have a high level of expectation for yourself, that tends to also bleed outward into everything else that you do, right? So it's not like you could be high energy in your job, but you're lethargic in other areas. You just tend to be, you are who you are. So Brian has this high expectations, and he's not shy. So he called me up, and it was a weekend. He called me up and he said, "Hey, David, Brian Benstock here." He says, "Listen, you know, I was so excited when I saw your product and I knew what it could do for our organization. I got my people so excited about it. I came back, I told them, and it takes 2 months to get the product online because there's things that have to happen from a data perspective. And so we're waiting and we're building up this anticipation, and this gentleman comes out. He's a nice enough guy. And, you know, did he do the training? Yes, he did the training, but he just checked the boxes. And it was so underwhelming that it was a complete letdown for my team. And frankly, you know, it was embarrassing for me. And I said, no problem. I said, I'll handle it. I said, I'm going to book a flight and I'm going to come out there and I'm going to do it myself as the CEO of the company. I booked a flight. I was on a flight the next day on a Sunday. I booked the flight. I came across country, I land, I go to baggage claim to get my garment bag, and it's not there. And I'm thinking, okay, let me just take inventory here. It's Sunday afternoon, it's about 4 o'clock, I'm an hour from the city, and I have no clothes to wear, no problem. So I made some calls, I contacted a gentleman at Barney's in men's suits. I said, I got an issue here. Can you help me out? He says, if you could get here by 5 o'clock. I said, done.
That's a big deal, by the way. Stores, especially on Sunday, close around like 6.
That's right. 6 is it. It's a witching hour, right? So I got there, thankfully, at 5 o'clock. He had already laid out some suits. Brilliant. I'm a pretty easy guy to work with. I'm not a high maintenance dude. And when it comes to size, I don't need a lot of tailoring, thank God. And so I picked out the suit. As I had told him in advance, I have to walk out with this suit. Well, long story boring, I went there, I picked the suit. The guy was phenomenal. I tried it on. He brought his tailor down. And in less than an hour, I walked out with a suit. And you have to understand, I had to walk out with a suit, the shirt, the belt, the shoes, the socks, the underwear, I mean, all of it. You don't think it wasn't just a suit. I had to have everything. So while they're tailoring it, I'm going over to the shoes and he's helping. I'm picking out shoes. So I ended up with everything. I went in the next morning and I did what should have been done. I did what I would expect any one of my own associates and what we have always done, what we became legendary for. That's what I delivered. And that was about 6 years ago. And I've had a phenomenal relationship. In fact, I've really become a partner to Astorna. I've become a trusted executive advisor to Brian, to his management team. And that's my approach with everything. That's my belief that every expectation should be met, right? You're in hospitality, right, Pablo?
Correct. Yeah.
So it's so critically important because you have so many touch points with us as business travelers or as vacation travelers, and each one of those is an opportunity to accomplish a couple things. One is to meet or exceed our expectations, and the other one is a very simple principle that I live by. I go out every day in the hopes that I will leave everybody better than I found them. And it doesn't sound like much, but I think it's important because it has exponential impact on human beings. If I go into a restaurant, and we've all been in this situation, and they're busy, or right now COVID, oftentimes you'll find that restaurants are understaffed because they're desperately trying to figure out a way to stay profitable and stay afloat. I get it. So you go into a restaurant, and it just happened the other day. Fabulous restaurant, clearly understaffed. The staff was clearly overwhelmed. 10 minutes, no menu. No interactions. So you have two choices. You can rightfully get frustrated and maybe even rightfully say, what in the bloody H is going on? What does it take to get a menu? Can I just get some water? Or you could pivot and say, hey, listen, it looks like you are completely slammed and overwhelmed right now. We could use some menus and some water when you get a moment, but don't worry about it. Don't sweat it. We're fine. Well, by virtue of taking that second approach, that person is now going from anxiety-ridden and stressed out and frustrated to exhaling. And as a result of that, everybody that they serve just got an upgrade. They just got a better version of that person, right? And so I think that we forget oftentimes that no matter where you are in life, in terms of your social status, your income, your job, your title, everybody has the power to leave every individual that they interact with better than they found them or worse than they found them. And if you leave them better than you found them, then you are indirectly, but mostly indirectly, making a contribution to a lot of things that are important today, especially in the world that we live in right now, to where there's too much, to me, there's too much angst, too much hate, too much anger, too much divisiveness. And if you take that tact, I think it's such a simple but powerful thing that we can
do. One of the things I take from those stories is that your all-in approach, and this is what you see in a lot of the guests on our podcast who are highly motivated, is that there's an intensity in the short term that leads to action, but it's ultimately an investment in A, the long term, that relationship where you are investing in that long-term relationship, and the associate at Barney's was investing in a long-term relationship, and B, there is a bigger, greater purpose that drives the quality of the relationship.
And C, I've also noticed this, they're all good problem solvers. That was a major takeaway, not only from that story, but just everybody that we've spoken to, they have been problem solving in real time. Okay, we hit a pandemic, what can we do for our industry? What can we do for our community? Like, and even right down to, okay, we're in a pandemic, this person is probably stressed out, how can we help them feel a little less anxious? They are just great problem solvers. And this, to me, is like the culmination moment.
But you also have that empathy from having been on the food and beverage side early on. And I know, I really believe that our personal journeys and the things that we've had exposure to, the community that you grew up in, the things that got you to that point, impact you in incredible ways. If you have never waited tables, or you've never worked in a kitchen, or you've never known anything about handling food in any way, you sit down in a restaurant and you're oblivious to how the sausage is made, right? Like you're the mechanics of how something happens.
Yeah.
And do you mind telling us a little bit about, like, you know, back in the day when you were in a kitchen at one point, right?
It was, yeah. And it's a wonderful point that you bring up and that Dahlia brings up, because what percentage of the population do you suppose walks into a restaurant for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, and that's merely a transaction? Right? It's merely, I'll tell you what, I'm going to make you a deal. I'm going to sit down here. You bring me food. I'll give you money. You go your way. I'll go my way. See you later. It might as well be faceless. They're nameless. Right? And that's the end of that transaction. You know, I believe that because of the fact that, you know, my upbringing, and I won't go into the way, way back, because that's not a happy story. And it's real life, but it's not a happy story. So, you know, so many people in this country and around the world, you know, you end up with less than the Hallmark family, you know, that prototypical flawless American family dynamic where everything's just goes swimmingly. You know, mine was not that way, like many people. You know, it was a tough childhood. But that's, I believe, what forges you, you know, into who you ultimately become. That, and then if you're fortunate enough to be around somebody who is, can have a great and positive impact. That was my mom. And my mom taught me, despite having this terrible ordeal and this terrible situation, you know, she never was a victim. She never pointed fingers. She never looked out the rear view window. She was always looking forward. It was always about live and let live, love all, serve all. And she created a work ethic in me and a belief system that really manifested itself in a lot of positive ways. So I ended up as a young guy, I ended up as a busboy in a restaurant. And I went from there to having the opportunity to be a server. And I went from there to saying, you know, I really want to be in the kitchen. Why I said that, I don't know, because that's a very hard life in the kitchen. Hospitality is not an easy business, as you know, for a lot of reasons. But especially if you work in a restaurant, the hours in working in the kitchen are bizarre. You get there in the morning and you're doing all your prep and you're there at night by the time you clean that kitchen and wipe it down and be done. So I did that, and I started as a prep chef, and then I ended up on a line chef, and then I ended up on the line itself. Cooking.
Was this before the Navy or after the Navy?
Both. I did some before the Navy, to be sure. That's where it started. And then I came out of the Navy, and I continued to do it. I always had this belief. You talk about motivation, for whatever it's worth. My belief system is, everybody's going to sleep X amount of hours. Some of us sleep 4 or 5. That's me. Some people are going, no, I got to have my 8 or 9. God bless you. I wish I was one of you. My brain doesn't work that way. It never turns off. But the hours in between, you're either making money or spending money. That's been my belief system. And so I was the guy that always had 2 jobs, sometimes 3 jobs. So I did work some afterwards. And so, you know, it taught me a lot about empathy. I didn't know until then, for example, that when you tip, that those tips are split between the kitchen staff and the busser and the server. So you go out and you have a meal for $100, you go, I'll tell you, $20, go buy yourself something pretty. Well, they don't get $20, right? They end up getting $20, they might get 60% of that. So, okay, they're getting $12 off of that. And you could say, well, it's not my problem, but you got service from the busser and you got service from the kitchen. It took a lot, to your point, Pablo, to make that happen. And so that taught me a lot about just how it works. It taught me a lot about the grind. It taught me a lot if you've ever been a server and your place closes at 10 and it's been dead and you've made no money.
Yeah.
And every time somebody walks in at 9:45 p.m., like at that point, you're like, I'm done. This has been a complete disaster. I'm just going to go home and I'm going to chill out. Nope. Somebody shows up at 10 minutes to 10 and they want to sit down. And guess what? They're never the ones that sit down and get in and out in 45 minutes. Nope. They're the ones that are going to want 6 cups of coffee after 3 glasses of wine. And you're just going to have to settle in. So it teaches you a lot about patience, about discipline, about empathy, about, you know, how things work there. And so I will never, ever go into a restaurant and be transactional. And I was very well known in San Francisco, where I lived for most of my life, that if a new restaurant opened, you know what I did? I went in that restaurant and I always purposely sat at the bar.
And that's so funny. That's usually my seat of choice, too.
Okay. You know what? I prefer the bar because that's where life is happening.
Yeah.
Right? And I want to interact with the people in the restaurant. I don't want to just sit there, put my head down, get my phone out, and order food and say, bring me food, bring me drinks, and see you later. You go, what?
You're right. The energy is at the bar.
The bar is the life of the place, right? So I sit there, and you end up meeting people. You turn to the left, you turn to the right, you turn to the right to Pablo, and you say, hey, what's your story? And that was always my opening line, what's your story? And people would talk. And I'd turn to you and I'd say, what's your story? I have lifelong friends that I met at sitting at a bar in a restaurant. But the other thing that's really cool about it is as I'm sitting there, instead of just ordering and paying, before I got my meal or shortly after I got my meal, when the bartender comes over and says, is everything okay? I said, actually, it's great. In fact, I said, is your manager here? There's a general manager here. I would love to meet her or him. Yes. And they would invariably go find their GM. They'd bring him over. And I said, listen, I know how tough this is. And I just had to take the time to introduce myself. And I really wanted to meet you because I wanted to let you know that your staff is phenomenal. Right? And I just want to wish you the very best. And I want to let you know I'm coming back and I'm bringing people with me. Right? And I would meet that person. I knew the name of the bartender. I knew the name of the bar back. I knew the name of the GM. Well, here's my rule. You go in the restaurant, you sit at the bar, and you go through that process. You know when I'd come back? The very next night. And now I came back and I knew a few people and I'd say hi to that GM. And then I'd come back a week later and then I'd come back 2 weeks later. And by the time I'm 2 weeks in, it doesn't matter if it's the hottest restaurant in town. They know me, I know them, and I never
have a relationship.
But it's about building a relationship.
And you're a sales guy. So when did you first figure out that you had that? Because you either have that or you don't, right? That ability to tap into the human connection and then turn that into a viable way of making a living.
You know, that's a good point. I agree with you. Except I'm wondering, and this is where I think we're confusing things, at least on my end, are you a sales guy or are you a business development guy where you're building those relationships, you're building a longevity as opposed to selling them on something?
It's an interesting question because, and you know, we partner, we have a partnership with Jay Abraham, and Jay Abraham says something that's absolutely on point. There's a difference between a customer and a client.
Yeah.
Right?
I agree
with
that.
And that's the difference between a salesperson and a biz dev person. So a salesperson is transactional by nature. A customer is somebody that you transact with, typically on a one-time basis with no preordained expectation of having ongoing transactions, right? A client is somebody that you transact with, but you also develop a long-term relationship. That's what a biz dev person does. Think of a biz dev person as being the software as a service, right? Recurring revenue, where the other person is a managed services, right? Which is just a transactional type of a person. And I would like to think of myself, I'm proud of being a salesperson, but I'm proud of the fact also that I don't sell. I inform, I engage, I develop relationships. I try to provide people additional information and insights maybe they didn't have before, because I believe very much that the only way, you can't change somebody's mind, but if you provide them additional information, it can cause them to draw a different conclusion. And so I'm very much on the client side. And I really believe that you know, everybody's a salesperson to some degree, right? Your pastor has got to be a pretty good salesperson. I mean, come on. That's how they keep in business, right? Because even a church is a business, right? A nonprofit. If you're a director of a nonprofit, you better be a pretty good salesperson, because it's pretty tough out there to get grants and to get a family foundation's money and everything else. And of course, if you are a person that relies on selling something, I hope you're a salesperson. It's interesting that people like real estate people oftentimes go up and call them a salesperson and they'll be downright offended. 90% of them will be offended, but 90% of them are also have more of a hobby than a business, because more than half of real estate people seem to make no money because they're not into the business development side. They're transactional by nature. So I really believe that whatever's in your inside comes out, right? And I'm somebody who values authenticity above all. I don't have to agree with you. I don't have to buy into your points. You could have a different religion. You could be a different political party. I don't care. If you treat people with respect and dignity, I don't care. If you don't have politics or manipulation or arrogance, we're good. We're good. I just want you to be authentic. That's all. Number two, so whatever's on your inside comes out. If you have a natural curiosity, you have an inquisitive nature, if you naturally love to connect with people, if you're naturally curious, the reason why it may be unfortunate if you sit next to me, Dahlia, on a plane is because if you're not plugged in, you may not know it, but we're chatting.
We're talking.
We're talking, man. And I'm going to say, what's your story? And I've met some incredible human beings. My mom...
I reverse engineered that on you. I don't know if you remember. I was in charge of moderating a room on Clubhouse that randomly happened. And all of a sudden, I found myself asking David questions without him even realizing that I was interviewing him. And that was
okay
how we
that.
Started building our relationship. So I actually did it to you, which is so fascinating.
I love that. I love that. And I'm happy. I'm a willing participant. I have this I have some things that are, I think, very, in however anybody wants to interpret this, who listens to this, I have some childlike qualities at the age of 61 still. I still have this very real sense of wonder. I still have this situation where I think every day there's going to be something in the mailbox that's good news. When the phone rings, I think somebody's going to tell me something awesome. And I believe that the next person I meet may very well be the most impactful person in my entire life. And the interaction may last an hour or less, but they may have a greater impact than people I've known for 10 years. So, and those things have always served me well. And I think that if you think about it, those things in and of itself create motivation, right? Because when you're curious, when you have this desire to engage with people, when you believe that something great is about to happen, you're far more motivated, if you think about it, than somebody who is downtrodden or somebody who tends to be negative by nature, somebody who fears rejection, for example. There is no phenomenal success story that is not filled with rejection. None. Zero.
I agree with you 100% about, I don't know that I share the same childlike quality, which I think is really,
it's not too late.
Which is lovely. I love it. But I do believe that every day that you wake up could be the most important day in your life. And the reason I, and both on the negative and the positive, but the outcome is the same, that you have to be plugged into your day, because the person that got a cancer diagnosis, or who was blindsided by a vehicle, you know, at an intersection, or who won a lottery, or who got an unexpected promotion, did not wake up that morning thinking that any of those things were going to happen. And they did, for good or for worse. And so the intensity that you bring to your day each day needs to be in parallel with the level of possibility, right?
Yeah.
If you closed off the possibilities, then I want to make a slight little pivot.
And by the way, does it apply towards the law of attraction versus action? And
yeah.
How does that fit into that, right? Like, is it random? Do we believe in coincidences? I mean, I personally am sometimes very superstitious, where I won't talk about something positive because I don't want to jinx it. I don't want something bad to happen to it.
So interesting.
Like,
that is not the approach, certainly, of an irrational optimist, to be sure. And I'm not saying to anybody that you should be irrationally optimistic. There's a pretty good group of you out there, and it's not terrible. Beats the heck out of the opposite. But it's interesting that you bring that up, because I've been somebody my whole life who believes that we don't get what we want, we get what we expect, right? And so, you know, if you expect to win, if you expect to be successful, if you expect to not win but to overcome, which means you still had rejection, you still had an obstacle, you still had somebody blocking your path or something blocking your path, but your underlying belief system was you were going to beat that too, right? And you talked about somebody who wakes up and finds out they get cancer, right? And I can share with you stories of people that got cancer and at the end of the day ended up with a better outlook and a better attitude and a better outcome than the person who won the lottery. Because there's a huge percentage of the people that win the lottery that what happens to them? They go
worst thing that could have
they
happened.
They go broke, their relationships fall apart, their family starts fighting.
Yep.
Right? They discover that while they just got riches beyond their wildest dreams, it cost them everything else that was dear to them. And then you go back to this other person who discovered an inner strength and a courage and a purpose and a mission. And whether they survived or not is even, it's immaterial. Because it turns out the cancer didn't beat them, right? Did it take their life? Possibly. Did it beat them? Absolutely not.
There
right?
are environmental factors. I'm going to touch on one
100%.
Real quick. Because I think this is pretty interesting. I've never met you before today, but we've spoken.
Sure.
Dahlia met you through Clubhouse, which is an auditory experience. and you have this beautiful white hair. So anyone who's anyone who's listening, right, he has the purest white hair that is very flattering.
Thank you.
That you got at an early age.
Yeah, started in my teenage years.
And so that must have influenced
how people
perceived you early on, right?
It influenced how I perceive myself.
And I also do believe that you have an old soul, so I think you can connect to people on a different level.
Very much. It's so interesting, you know, this feels like an M. Night Shyamalan moment. Right? You've got a sixth sense, you rewind the tape, and it's a really interesting thing. I'll give you an insight I don't typically share. I have very few childhood memories, very few. And I would have probably virtually none if it wasn't for old photographs. And what happens when you look at old photographs with my situation, you all of a sudden go, oh yeah, I remember that. I think of that. But I had this thing that I thought was almost a safety device that just allowed me to block out things and to focus on the good, right? So it's interesting looking back, because I remember getting my first white hairs when I was 15, 16 years old, and you think, what exactly is going on here? You didn't think it was the greatest thing in the world, typically. Most people that I've met in my life want to retain their youth, recapture their youth, relive their youth, find something that would give them their youth back, whether it's, what is the one that starts with an R? It's either Botox or, I can't remember.
Restylane,
right? Something. Give me some Restylane, collagen, Botox, something, facelifts, whatever, to do that. I've been the opposite. And I think, as you said that, as I got these white hairs, and maybe combined with my curiosity, and maybe that combined with my underlying positive outlook, I couldn't wait to get older. I could not wait to get older. Because in my mind, older meant liberation. Older meant more responsibility. Older meant more opportunities. Older meant more control of what I could do, where I can go, you know, and so forth. And then I discovered something in my 20s as I got more and more white hairs, and I never ran from it. I never dyed it. My mom, I remember to this day, here's one memory I have, is my mom's head in the sink and my mom was tiny, 5 feet tall, and her little head couldn't even fit in this little sink. But I remember her squeezing the black, looked like she was squeezing black ink on her head because she was prematurely white. And my father was prematurely white, and she couldn't stand it, so she was dyeing her hair this jet black. She's Hispanic. And I never had a desire to do that, because by then I was in sales, and I was thinking this could help me, because people are going to look at my hair and not at my face. And it's really true.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny, you don't realize it, for anybody out there, you don't realize it. But people will look at certain parts of you. They'll engage with certain parts of you, and they're going to draw conclusions. There was a book called Dress for Success by John T. Malloy 100 years ago. He was the guy that came up with the blue suit, the IBM uniform, red tie, white shirt, blue suit. And I learned the expression, fake it till you make it. I had less than no money. No money would have been something I was aspiring to be. I had less than no money. And I wanted to be in sales, and I wanted to leverage the fact that I looked older than I was, and I believed people would focus on my head and not my face. And they would presume with my hair I had more experience than I did, more knowledge than I did. And I learned that when I did get a little bit of money, I made money, go buy the nicest tie you could afford and the nicest pair of shoes you could afford. Everything else could be a disaster. It could be, you could have bought it from a thrift store. But they always look down at your shoes, and they always notice your tie, right? And so with my white hair and that belief system and that knowledge, it really worked in my favor environmentally, right? And so people always presumed.
One thing I really wanted us to be able to at least tap into is there's this philanthropic side to the work that you're doing. And one of the things that I find absolutely fascinating is that high achievers, highly motivated, whatever you want to brand this group of people, have so much going on, multiple businesses, and yet seem to find the extra time, and I'm putting extra in between quotation marks because where does it come from,
right? Yeah.
To leave the world a better place, to impact other people's lives more positively, and to do it with passion. And I'm not talking about writing checks, because that I'm talking about devoting time and energy. And I know that you do a lot of mentorship.
Sure.
And you make yourself available to a lot of people, and that you are also tapped into some really great causes. So I wanted to make sure that we could at least touch on that before
okay.
we end it.
Yeah.
I was very fortunate to have empathy embedded in me. I'm very fortunate to be raised by my mother for a lot of reasons. I won't go into it. There's many, but I am who I am because of her. And so one of those things was just significant empathy for people around me. And at one point, you know, I was beyond broke. I was living in a car, but I was Pursuit of Happiness 30 years before Pursuit of Happiness, right? Live in my car. I had suits in my car. I would go to the back of this hotel convention center, and I knew the door was open, and I can get ready, I can shave, I can clean up. And then I'd go to San Francisco, suited up, looking the best that I could look. And I remember, you know, walking past homeless people on the street, and the irony. You talk about, people talk all the time about imposter syndrome. They don't know imposter syndrome, a lot of people. But imposter syndrome is walking down the street in a suit, being as broke as the people that you're walking by that are homeless, knowing that you're going to go home and live in a car. And so even though I had no money, what I learned is the power that, again, all of us really have. It's inherent in us that, you know, that most people, if you walk by them, a homeless person, their head is invariably down. And that's a sign that they don't feel that they're worthy. And so when you walk by somebody who's homeless, or you see them and you stop on the street and you engage them in a conversation, you look them in the eye and you say, good morning, how are you? Just how are you? You don't know the last time somebody asked them, how are you? And you don't think when that person is somebody's brother, husband, father, son, daughter, aunt, whatever it might be, but they are somebody. But chances are they've forgotten that they're somebody, and we contribute to that. So I learned the power that any of us have. If you have $100 to your name, or no dollars to your name, or $1 million to your name, fast forward. As I was fortunate enough to do well, and I was fortunate enough to meet my wife who shares my passion, we created a foundation called Equality for All, HDI, Equality for All. H is Honey, D is David, Honey and David Incorporated. Why HDI? Because corporations outlive people, and our partnership, our relationship, we believe should outlast us. So we created that. We provide support and financial support, but other support to about 70 different nonprofits. We moved into Oregon about 5 years ago. We knew nobody, and we wanted to get engaged in the philanthropic side because we were very philanthropic in San Francisco. So we did that. But to your point, you bring up a really important point. It's easy to write a check, right? And if that's all you have time. If you don't have time for anything else, you can write a check, right? If you could do nothing else but tell people about a nonprofit because you don't have money to write a check, then do that, because you're indirectly contributing. But if you could go beyond that and you could mentor them, because nonprofits are businesses too. Your customers don't pay them, but they're a business and they need to operate like a business. So I love being able to facilitate relationships, help bring money into the organization, but I also love to teach them how to be better business people, because that allows them to be able to serve more people. And so what's important to us is to be able to touch as many people as we possibly can, and secondarily, to raise our two boys, who are 6 and 5, just about 5, to grow up to be not salespeople, not a doctor, but to be good citizens and to be philanthropists. We're raising philanthropists. And as an entrepreneur, I want my kids, and this might seem outlandish or preposterous to some people, I want my boys, by the time they're 12, to have experienced a failed business, because I want them to start some kind of business. If they succeed, great. If they fail, it's all right. But I also want them to do that so that they can experience what it's like to be a philanthropist.
David, so there is so much here, and I want to keep going. Can we cancel our next meeting? Like, this is just so good.
Well, listen, I'm very fortunate to have met you both. And Clubhouse has been a remarkably fascinating, weird, peculiar at times, questionable at times, but it has allowed me to meet extraordinary people in a way that would have never been possible. And for that, I'm forever grateful, you know, to meet you, and for you to introduce me to Pablo has been a blessing as well. And I've loved the conversation. There's so much we could talk about. I almost feel like we didn't talk enough about the motivation side.
We didn't. There's so much more. There's going to be a part two of this one. We have to.
I promise that this was a foundational conversation. I promise if there is a part two, if I'm fortunate enough to continue the conversation, we will focus 100% on how do I elevate motivation? How do I keep myself motivated? How do I stay motivated when things are going all wrong? You know, and what's the difference between inspiration and motivation?
Oh, that's the teaser for the next podcast.
And here's the last one. Why sometimes inspiration and motivation in and of themselves together are not enough. There's a third component that has to enter the picture. Inspiration is going to get you off the sofa. Motivation is going to get you to go do something, hopefully in a repeated fashion. But if you don't have the third one, chances are very high you're not going to get to where you want to get to. And I'm not even going to tell you what that
third one is. You have to. Is it action? It's action.
No, motivation is going to cause action. Purpose is great, but that's not it. It's commitment. If you find anybody who has succeeded at the highest level, the one thing that you will find, at some point they were inspired. Inspiration is oftentimes evangelical in nature. It evaporates, right? Motivation is oftentimes misused, misunderstood, and even abused. Leaders oftentimes will motivate people, you know, by saying, if you do this, you get this. If you don't do this, you get, you know, something bad. And negative motivation and positive motivation. But unless you have that third piece, the commitment to the end goal, and right, we could talk about a lot of things, but we will save it for later. But I will promise you, as we get through that conversation, that you will absolutely learn some things that have been invaluable to me, but more importantly, invaluable to everybody who's been able to combine inspiration, motivation, and commitment.
Thank you, David, this was amazing. Thank you for being here.
I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Be sure to subscribe to the Motivated Podcast, and also stay tuned on LinkedIn and Instagram for some behind the scenes and extra updates.